Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In 1987, the Lawrence Eagle Tribune wrote this about a recent criminal case. Quote, "The question everyone wants answered is how a cold-blooded murderer ever got out in the first place."
1 year later, the entire nation was asking that same question because of this 30-second television ad.
Bush and Dukakis on crime. Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
That was the infamous Willie Horton weekend passes ad. It completely transformed the 1988 presidential race. Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis was running against Vice President George H.W. Bush. Soon after the ad aired, Bush and many other Republicans invoked Horton's name on the campaign trail almost every day.
There's a story about a fellow named Willie Horton.
Willie Horton.
Convicted murderer.
Murderer.
Convicted murderer, Willie Horton.
Willie Horton.
Weekend vacations.
Weekend passes.
Cold-blooded.
Convicted murderer.
First degree.
Convicted murderer.
Killer.
Murderer.
They rape people.
Raped his wife.
They maul people.
Willie Horton will become household name.
No more furloughs for people that rape, pillage, and plunder.
That's from Boogeyman, the Lee Atwater story. Atwater was Bush's campaign strategist. He famously said that by the time the race was over, voters would wonder whether Willie Horton was Dukakis' running mate.
Michael Dukakis lost the 1988 presidential election, and the Willie Horton ad changed how politicians talked about and dealt with crime for decades.
But now it's 2015, and we're at the beginning of another presidential race. Crime rates have fallen, and both Democrats and Republicans talk more openly about the failures of the criminal justice system. So, has the ghost of that Willie Horton ad been purged from American politics?
That's the provocative question asked in a deeply thoughtful piece by Beth Schwartz-Apfel and Bill Keller. It's called Willie Horton Revisited, and it's featured on the Marshall Project website, a nonpartisan news organization that covers the criminal justice system. Beth Schwartz-Apfel joins us in the studio now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So listeners, if you remember the Willie Horton ad and how it changed presidential politics, call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800 423 talk. And if you think that the way politicians are talking about crime and criminal justice today is changing, call us as well or send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Beth, really fantastic piece of work. But let's actually just sort of take a step back and take a few minutes to go over in detail, you know, exactly the case of Willie Horton first, a little bit of background on him. He didn't grow up in Massachusetts, but ended up living in Lawrence, Massachusetts. And as you write in the story, he remembers himself as being one of the four top drug dealers in the area that he knew of. So tell us more about him.
Sure. So Horton grew up in the South, wandered north to Massachusetts. He followed a girlfriend up here. And yeah, as he told me, he was caught up in the sort of glamorous life of dealing drugs at that time. He talked to me about all the cars that they drove, the fancy leather coats that they had, their Superfly hats and other things like that.
He told you it was his way of achieving the American dream.
He did. And he was very earnest about that. He had a young daughter at that time and talked about wanting to provide for her. He did sort of concede that there was some thrill in the glamour of the life, and does say now that that was wrong. But at the time, he was very caught up in this whole scene.
Well, in October of 1974, there is a crime, a terrible crime, that's committed against a 17-year-old gas station attendant, Joseph Fournier. How was Horton involved with that?
So there was conflicting testimony at that trial. Horton and two friends robbed a gas station where Fournier was the attendant. And the three men disagree on which of the three of them went into the gas station. But two of them did. One of them waited in the car. And when all was said and done, Joseph Fournier was stabbed 19 times and stuffed into a trash can.
I mean, it's an awful crime.
It's horrible.
And as you point out in the piece, it doesn't really matter who did the stabbing because of the legal concept known as joint enterprise. Enterprise. He was part of the group of three, Horton was.
Exactly.
So he got a life sentence.
Exactly. And all 50 states have some variation on this joint enterprise doctrine. Some states call it felony murder, where anyone who's involved in the commission of a crime where somebody dies is equally culpable for that murder.
Okay. So Willie Horton's in prison. After some time, he becomes eligible for furlough, and you know, in a way, like the word furlough is forever tainted by the 1988 campaign. We'll talk about that in a minute. But you actually do have some tape of what Willie Horton, you know, recently told you about the furlough program as it was during that time in the 1980s. So let's listen to this. This is Willie Horton describing what he used to do in the furloughs that he took.
Once I became eligible for furlough, I put in for a furlough. You had to have a certain amount of years in. You had to have a pretty good prison record, things of that nature. You had to be a model citizen with inside the prison. I was approved through the system. Most time I went to church or I was traveling, and I would go home and spend time with my daughter as much as I could.
So it's a bit of a rough line there. I mean, obviously he's talking from inside a prison, but he basically said he was trying to be a model citizen, and he had to have a pretty good prison record to be put on the furlough program. And when he went on furlough, he'd go home and spend time with his daughter as much as he could. But then on one of his furloughs, his last one, he basically runs away from the police, lives on the lam for a year, and is then... This other awful crime happens.
Yeah, so in the 80s, it's hard for us to wrap our heads around this, but furloughs were a very widespread tool. Almost every state had a furlough program where these were used as sort of an incentive for good behavior. You know, if you had a certain number of years of good behavior, you could leave the prison for, and depending on the state and depending on your crime, a couple of hours, a couple of days, and you could go out and, you know, Horton said he used to go shopping with his daughter, he would go to church, things like that. And the story is a little bit murky about what happened on this was his 10th furlough. So he had had 9 uneventful furloughs. So why would somebody who had gone out and come back in 9 times without event suddenly take off? Horton says he just sort of lost it. He told me he was in the car with a young woman. A cop pulled them over. And the young woman sort of looked at him almost flirtatiously and said, "What are you going to do?" And he just kind of stepped on the gas and drove away.
Well, it drove away, then moves to Florida. So he's like he's officially now a fugitive, and then moves to Baltimore.
Correct. And it's when he's in Baltimore that this horrible home invasion happens.
Right. The home invasion of Clifford Barnes and Angela Miller.
Right. So this happened in April 1987. This young couple who's living in this D.C. suburb has their home broken into. The man is tied up in the basement. It's a horrific crime. He's slashed. He's beaten. His girlfriend comes home in the middle of the night and she's raped. The person's wearing a stocking mask, so neither of the couple can say exactly what he looked like, but he did take off in the man's Camaro. And Horton was driving that Camaro not long after that when the police caught up with him.
Okay. So this is 1987, and of course... The very next year, there is a presidential race. And in between 87 and the summer of 88, as we mentioned at the top of this segment, the Lawrence Eagle Tribune was running a lot of stories about what happened to Willie Horton. How could the second crime have been committed? And what was the effect of that on the furlough program in Massachusetts? Governor Dukakis changed the law.
Correct. Prior to that series, people who were convicted of first degree murder in Massachusetts were eligible for furloughs under certain circumstances. And as a result of this sort of relentless public pressure, Dukakis ended the furlough program for those convicted of first degree murder.
Okay. So we should say that in 1988, when the Willie Horton ad first airs, it actually hadn't been the first time that Dukakis, the candidate, had to face the question of what Horton did on furlough.
Yeah, it's a little bit of an apocryphal story that Al Gore was the first to bring up Willie Horton. Al Gore never mentioned Willie Horton by name, but he did in a primary debate sort of challenge Dukakis on the furlough program in general and asked, you know, would you have these kind of furloughs for the federal system if you were the president? Which is sort of ironic because, in fact, there was already a furlough program in the federal system at that time. But apparently the audience audience thought that was a hilarious question, cracked up, the LA Times reported. And, you know, the answer seemed to be an obvious and resounding no.
Mm. Well, let's talk in more detail then about how this affected the presidential race between George H.W. Bush and Michael Dukakis, because by the summer of 1988, or thereabouts, I believe, Dukakis was actually up in the polls quite significantly. Mm-hmm. So when this ad first aired, the Bush campaign was trying to come back from behind. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, you report in your story in the Marshall Project that Lee Atwater, who was Vice President Bush's political strategist, you know, he famously said that they were going to talk about this so much that voters would think Willie Horton was Mike Dukakis's running mate. But he also called this a gut issues, a values issues, which would resonate particularly in the South. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, sure. I mean, Lee Atwater claimed that Willie Horton's race didn't matter at all. And in fact, in our story, there's a clip of him saying, I don't think most people in the South even know what race Willie Horton is, which seems to be pretty patently false. You know, he was...
Well, the ad had his picture in it.
Of course it did. Yeah. And in fact, there was also a picture of this white guard sort of leading him by the arm. And Horton's tall. He's taller than 6 feet. And he's sort of towering over this white guy and sort of looking down at him. So I think the pictures they chose were specifically chosen to look really menacing and really scary. But, you know, I think if you had asked Atwater, he would have said, well, any murderer is going to be scary. He just happens to be black. But when he uses terms like gut issues and values issues, he sort of reveals what's going on underneath his language.
Right. And so how did that then dovetail with voters' attitudes about crime and criminal justice itself in the mid to late 80s?
It's hard to remember now because crime rates are so low. They're at historic lows, and they have been now for years. But the 80s were a very violent time, and people were scared. And I think there was a certain level of panic going on in the electorate, and people were just looking for politicians who promised to crack down on criminals. And we're talking about, you know, everything from, you know, you park your car in a city and, you know, guaranteed at some point you're going to have your radio stolen, to these kind of home invasions, break-ins, violent crime, muggings, that kind of stuff was just very commonplace in the 80s, where it's very unusual now.
Mm. It's so interesting to think back to that time because we're going to talk more in a minute about how attitudes have changed. But even at that time, I mean, the Bush campaign knew that they had a very explosive issue on their hands. I mean, insofar as it was talking about race, I'm talking about crime and race, as we touched upon. And in fact, you know, the media sort of amplified all of this. Mm-hmm. The ad itself only ran for like a month.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
In a very limited media market, too.
Yeah. So you've got, we've got some tape here more of how Lee Atwater dealt with questions from the media about whether or not the ad was racist and whether or not the ad actually came from the Bush campaign, because while they were talking about it, they were also trying to distance themselves from it. So here's Lee Atwater being questioned by Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes.
Do you think the Willie Horton commercial, though, gives hints of racial politics?
I haven't seen the Willie Horton commercial.
You don't have a Willie Horton commercial on the air?
No.
A furlough program commercial?
Mm-mm.
You don't have a crime? You don't have an ad on the air about the
No.
crime issue?
Mm-mm.
Yet on the other hand, you also report that the Bush campaign had Horton's mugshot hanging up at their campaign headquarters.
It does strain credulity that the Bush campaign knew nothing about this ad. You know, Iles was involved in the production of this ad. He had very recently been employed by Atwater. They were mentioning Willie Horton almost every day. You know, I think you see a lot of this kind of political gymnastics even now, with PACs being seemingly independent or ostensibly independent when, you know, really there's obviously links between the PAC and the campaign.
And Iles being Roger Iles, who went on to found Fox News.
Correct.
Okay. Well, so what really is interesting about this is that you also spoke with Governor Dukakis, and he told you essentially one mistake that he felt he made, you know, in the midst of this campaign, when all of the Horton stuff was in this gigantic political maelstrom around him. And basically, he says he doesn't actually blame Horton himself.
The guy screwed up royally, but I don't blame him for my defeat in 1988. I mean, I blame myself. I mean, there was no reason under the sun why I shouldn't have been able to deal effectively with this. It turned out it was one of the dumbest decisions I ever made. I made a decision early in the campaign that I was not going to respond to the Bush attack campaign.
That's Governor Mike Dukakis speaking with reporter Beth Schwartz Apfel about why he didn't respond to the Willie Horton ads. I mean, what could he have done, though, at the time? There seemed to be like this juggernaut of emotional power behind what the Bush campaign was doing.
Well, what he told us was he could have produced a very similar ad because, you know, the federal program and the program in California under then-Governor Reagan both had very similar stories of people who were furloughed and then went on to commit another crime. It's sort of inevitable, and Dukakis said this to us, too. Anytime you release somebody from prison, there's always going to be that one case that goes wrong, no matter, you know, what the program is. You can't predict human behavior. So if there's a furlough program, inevitably there's going to be one terrible case. And what he said was he knew about several that had happened under Bush's watch when he was, vice president in the federal system. But he just thought, I don't want to get down in the mud with that campaign. I want to run a really positive campaign. I'm just not going to go there.
Which, I mean,
we all see how
with
that
the
worked
retrospect
out.
Of more than 25 years, one can question, obviously, whether or not that was the right decision. But now we're getting, you know, back into what is a very important legal backdrop here and you know, questions about how this ad not only changed presidential politics, but the criminal justice system as a whole. Because as you mentioned earlier, all 50 states in the 80s had some kind of furlough program that changed in Massachusetts very soon after the case of Willie Horton. In 1987, 10% of state and federal prisoners actually received furlough, and they were uncontroversial at the time. I mean, and as you just mentioned, even Ronald Reagan, when he was governor of California, held up the California furlough program as a model.
Even after two people released from that program went on to kill other people, yeah.
And he said 20,000 had already received furlough passes in California. So, but after Willie Horton, after the ad, what happened around the country regarding the furlough program?
Furloughs are almost unheard of now. Occasionally, states will run a very small furlough program, but they'll do it very under the radar. You know, they don't want any press for obvious reasons, because as soon as the public hears about it, they freak out and the program gets shut down. You know, the American public is extremely risk averse. You know, decision making around any criminal justice system is always going to be conservative decision making. Now, we can debate the merits on that, but that's how we ended up with, 2 million Americans in prison, is because it's always safer, you know, on paper anyway, to keep someone in prison than to let them out. It's always safer to deny somebody the opportunity to go back into their community than it is to keep them in prison. And so, especially when somebody's political reputation is on the line, they're always going to make the conservative choice. And we see the results of that now.
How much of it was because of what happened to Michael Dukakis in that campaign?
It's really hard to say. I think that there's a little bit of a chicken and egg question. You know, the public was already sort of panicking about crime during this period. So I think simultaneously the ad tapped into a pre-existing amount of anxiety around crime. At the same time, it sort of mobilized that anxiety, gave it a name, set it in motion. So it's hard to say how much is attributable to the ad and how much the ad just really very accurately captured the public sentiment at that time.
And it's not just the furlough programs themselves, which is only but one part of the criminal justice system. I mean, when you spoke to Willie Horton, who's 63 now and still in prison, he told you that many of the programs within the prison system that were once available to him when he first went in, he doesn't see them anymore. These programs for like substance abuse, educational opportunities, and we have a tape here from one of your interviews with Willie Horton. He calls prison simply a warehouse now.
The younger kids that come in now that's supposed to be gang related, they have nothing to feed and nurture their brain, except for what we older guys give them. What people don't understand is they got to come back into society one day.
That's Willie Horton speaking to you when? Just last year or year?
Early 2015.
Yeah, okay. So then there's these other programs that we were just mentioning here. Did those two also get severely cut back following 1980?
Absolutely. Yeah, basically any program that made, and I hesitate to use this phrase, but I'll just use it for convenience sake, any program that made the lives of prisoners better, more enriched, basically was on the chopping block throughout the 90s and the early 2000s. So one really good example is federal Pell Grants for prisoners. So before 1994, prisoners could get Pell Grants to take college courses. And there was a robust college system inside prisons. Now, the evidence is unequivocal that people who come out of prison with some college education commit less crimes, they reintegrate back into society better, they're able to get jobs more readily. But, you know, the public hears about that and they just say, you know, these guys should be breaking rocks. I don't want my taxpayer dollars sending them to college. I got to work hard to send my own kids to college. And you've got that kind of widespread sentiment around all of these programs. Anytime a dollar gets spent putting a television in a prison or a weight room in a prison, people say, why are my taxpayer dollars going to make their lives more comfortable?
Well, so this chicken and egg, I take your point, but it came to a head in 1988. And here we are almost three decades later. And there are many people saying, and I think legitimately so, that the way politicians talk today about the criminal justice system has changed quite dramatically. I mean, we've got some tape here from several politicians who either are president or are running for president, and just to serve as a counterpoint about how the discussion around crime has changed. So first, here's President Obama in the State of the Union address talking about mass incarceration.
Surely we can agree that it's a good thing that for the first time in 40 years, the crime rate and the incarceration rate have come down together, and use that as a starting point for Democrats and Republicans, community leaders and law enforcement, to reform America's criminal justice system so that it protects and serves all of us.
All right, so that was President Obama in January of this year. Here's Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul, who is running for president, speaking about another aspect of the criminal justice system, about fines and penalties, which can then lead many people to be forced to go to prison. He was speaking at Bowie State University in Maryland in March.
Those of us who have jobs and who have lived fairly privileged lives don't know what it's like to have to pay fines and then pay penalties on top of fines, and how someone's life can spiral out of control because of this.
And finally, here's Hillary Clinton, Democratic presidential candidate, speaking just last month.
If the United States brought our correctional expenditures back in line with where they were several decades ago, we'd save an estimated $28 billion a year, and I believe we would not be less safe. It's time to change our approach. It's time to end the era of mass incarceration.
So, Beth Schwartz-Apfel, I mean, it does seem as if the power of crime as an issue in presidential politics is quite different now than it was in 1988.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it used to be that crime was at the top of the list when, you know, these polling organizations would ask voters, what do you care most about in the election? It would always be in the top three. In the last election, you know, Gallup asked voters what they care most about, and they didn't even include crime on the list of things that they wanted voters to rank. So it's just lost its power as a political issue to a certain extent. You know, that's not to say that politicians don't still try to paint their opponents as soft on crime. That does come up from time to time. But at least as often, we see things like Clinton's speech, like Rand Paul's speech, where politicians try to go in the other direction and argue for a smarter, smaller criminal justice system.
So as a discussion, as a political discussion, that's one thing. But, you know, when it comes to the potency of crime as an issue in elections, I mean, in your reporting, it seems as if it's still there, though, because you have several examples of how, you know, frightening criminals have been used in close races.
The interesting thing is actually, you know, these politicians, they do try it. In almost every election, you see somebody try it. But what has started to happen is actually it stops working. And sometimes it even backfires. So the most egregious example was in Nebraska last year. There was this serial killer there named Nico Jenkins.
We actually have the ad that ran about this. So let's listen to this. This is from the National Republican Congressional Committee in a 2014 midterm ad that ran in Nebraska.
Four murders. murders in 11 days. A judge decides Nico Jenkins is responsible for all of them.
Nico Jenkins was released from prison early after serving only half his sentence. The head of the Omaha Police Union said Jenkins is the poster child for why the good time law is a farce. Brad Ashford supported the good time law and still defends it, allowing criminals like Nico Jenkins to be released early. The National Republican Congressional Committee is responsible for the content of this advertising.
One difference there, at least they had to identify themselves. So, I mean, it's still a potent issue.
Well, you would think so, except Brad Ashford, the criminal coddler, he won that election. That was actually one of several ads that his opponent, Lee Terry, ran, accusing him of being soft on crime. He ran another one about sex offenders. And the public basically seemed to shrug and say, yeah, we don't really buy that.
Well, I want to play one last piece of tape from Governor Dukakis himself, because I think he kind of disagrees with you.
I don't think there's any question about it. You get one of these horrendous cases, and all hell breaks loose.
I mean, that's Governor Dukakis saying that he doesn't actually think much has changed. A close race, maybe a battleground state, one really bad, awful case, and it could go back to 1988.
One can never predict the future. I mean, sure, you just don't know. But, you know, if recent history is any guide, you know, you just don't see these kind of ads getting the traction that they get, that they used to get. Even in Alaska, Mark Begich, who was the incumbent, ran this very inflammatory ad trying to tie his opponent to the release of this sex offender who then went on to commit another horrible crime. And in fact, the victims in that case wrote to Begich and said, take the ad down. You're offending us. And in fact, Begich lost the race. And people think that it was in large part because of the pushback he got from that ad. So it actually was backlash in that case.
Well, we'll see how this plays out in the presidential race as we head into 2016. Beth Schwartz-Apfel is a staff writer for the Marshall Project. It's a nonprofit news organization that covers the criminal justice system. Her piece, written along with Bill Keller, is called Revisiting Willie Horton. We have a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. Beth, thank you so much for coming in, and thank you for this great reporting.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, we'll be back in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.